What better way to end off a week-long fun drive than with a kick-ass party? On March 4th, join us at the Hindenburg on West Cordova from 8 p.m. to 2 a.m. for a night-long celebration of all your support and commitment to community radio. It's one rad night you won't want to miss. We've got a silent auction, CITR DJ spinning, and the launch of Pop Alliance Volume 4 with Mint Records. To help us launch the album, we've got Morning Coup, Stefana Fratila, Late Spring, Aura Kogan, Ace Martins, Jerk Jails, and Kelt Babies coming to perform for you. Tickets are $10 online or $12 at the door. For tickets and info, check out CITR on Facebook.
Year, you and your community show your support for CITR by donating with FunDrive, our annual fundraiser. Get involved again this year with our theme, Growing Our Cultures. This year, we've got a goal of $40,000 to improve the training and development of volunteers and to support the myriad of cultures represented on our airwaves. You can help us reach our goal, and it's not without perks. By donating, you'll receive cool CITR swag like growlers, LPs, on-air shoutouts, and more. We're excited. Are you?
Rendez-vous de la Francophonie is an annual celebration that promotes the French language, heritage, and its numerous cultural expressions. It runs March 6th to 22nd in communities across Canada. La Fondation Canadienne pour le Dialogue des Cultures, in partnership with the National Campus and Community Radio Association, through the Community Radio Fund of Canada and this station, present the RBF series. To help celebrate Rendez-vous de la Francophonie, in 2016, 24 campus and community radio stations from across Canada produce a weekly show highlighting Rendez-vous de la Francophonie events and the importance of bilingualism and Francophone culture and history of Canada. For more information, check out www.ncra.ca/RBF.
Better training and support means higher production quality for all of our programs. Better research, better audio, deeper analysis, and more informative and entertaining radio, all from your independent local perspective. Help us out here at CITR and donate this fun drive. This year, we're looking to increase the cultures on our airwaves and support our training. Go to citr.ca/donate or call 604-822-8648. 604-UBC-UNIT.
Tune in Sundays from 9 till 10 p.m. for bootlegs and B-sides with your host, Doran, for the finest in soul, dubstep, ghetto funk, and electro.
Oh, man.
What?
I really wanted to catch that football game, but I have to clean my room. I'm so bummed.
Yo, man, totally chill out. You can catch it on CITR.
CITR?
Did someone say CITR?
Yeah.
CITR Radio brings you Thunderbird Sports on the weekends. Catch all the action and don't miss a moment of play with our live play-by-play and color commentary. Only on CITR 101.9 FM.
Wow, that's great.
And if you can't catch the game, tune in at 3:30 p.m. every Thursday for our weekly update on UBC Athletics with live scores, recaps, and in-depth analysis.
Oh, okay, dude. Okay, dude. We get it.
Dude!
Only on CITR.
Welcome back. This is News 101. Today is Friday, February 26th. I'm Rohit Joseph.
And I'm Emily Blake. You're listening to News 101.9 FM, broadcasting to you live from unceded Musqueam territory here at the University of British Columbia, to our UBC campus, to the residents of Vancouver, and to our listeners of our newscast and podcast on our website, citr.ca.
Good evening. It is 5:16 p.m. and time for a full hour of independent campus, local, and international news.
Before we begin our show, we want to let you know that it's Fun Drive here at CITR. Great shows like News 101 are made possible through the generous support of donors.
And you can get some really cool CITR swag. In fact, we have some amazing prizes. So if you donate $30, you can get a Friends of CITR card. If you donate $60, you could get a Friends of CITR card plus a growler. How cool is that? And you also can get the ultimate 101.9 prize and get three things: a Friends of CITR card, a growler, and a notebook. But what about a swag bag? How do you get that, Emily?
Well, Rohit, you can donate $175.
And you get a swag bag and what?
And a growler, and a notebook, and a Friends of CITR card.
And an LP. How cool is that? So you'll be getting so many other great prizes. There's even a really, really grand one of $1,000. If you donate that much, you'll get a whole bunch of cool stuff, an on-air shout-out, a 10-song playlist of your choice, and recognition on CITR's donor wall in the new sub. So call 604-822-8648 or visit CITR.ca/donate and donate right now to help us reach our goal of $40,000 and keep CITR awesome.
So for this week's episode, we have a special treat. First, we have an in-studio panel covering the latest UBC news. We have UBC Forestry student Stephanie Glansman, who is also the outreach coordinator for Divest UBC, and Gabrielle John, the former advocacy officer on the UBC GSS, who recently completed her MA in political science.
Following that, we have Alex Norman's weekly financial report.
And to close up the show, we have a second live panel with AMS presidential candidates Jenna Massey, Ava Nasiri, and Aloha Dave. So to start our panel off, over a reading week, a number of important UBC stories broke, from the release of the executive summary of Pollard Butler's report to the Board of Governors' decision not to divest. Today, we have an in-studio panel to discuss these stories. Joining me are Stephanie Glansman.
Hi.
And Gabrielle John.
Hi there.
To start off our panel, last week UBC's Board of Governors made the decision not to divest from fossil fuels. Instead, the board voted to put $10 million towards a new fund that will invest in low-carbon ventures. This will be separate from the $1.4 billion UBC currently has in endowments. Steph, you're part of Divest UBC. Let's start with you. What was your reaction to the decision?
Myself, students, and other students, faculty members, and staff, there's a huge backlash against this decision. We have been campaigning hard for the past 2.5 years and have not received any, the Board of Governors would not take any meetings with us in informing their decision. So the fact that they went ahead and kind of dropped the divestment bomb and voting no to it after all the hard work and after two referendum votes, 22 members of the BOG essentially put down the decision against the wishes of students and faculty. So we are very disappointed, and yeah.
And I did hear that C350 was able to talk to the Board of Governors the same day that they were made the decision. What was that like?
It was very interesting. I've been attending meetings in the past 2 weeks with the Board of Governors, but attending that meeting was, there was some very kind of problematic tones that they were using, and the arguments that they would bring up around divestment are just very weak. We saw throughout the whole process non-transparency and a lot of rhetoric that isn't evidence-based, and that's what they base their decision on. So hearing them kind of back behind the wall of fiduciary duty in the meeting and saying, and kind of patting themselves on the back, saying that they did take adequate steps to address divestment when we know firsthand that we were not consulted with, and they dismissed reports that we would submit. So the meeting was definitely a huge chance for us to show up and like show them that this fight is not over. We were able to have one of our members, Alex Hemingway, speak to the meeting, address them and why divestment is something that UBC should be considering as we are a leader in sustainability. We had, once the vote passed, we, the students of C350, we made more of a hullabaloo in the meeting and essentially listed some quotes off that UBC higher-ups have said. Stephen Toop, we also cited the UBC sustainability commitment and just reiterated the fact that they are failing us as an institution. The Board of Governors has so much power in UBC in making political choices that will have huge environmental ramifications, but the fact that they chose not to act on divestment and didn't ever really consider it, it was tough for us, and they are failing us, and we said that loud and clear at the meeting, and I think that message got across to them that we are not going to be settling down after what they said. Yeah.
And Gabrielle, you're a recent graduate, but what was your reaction to the news?
Well, I was pretty embroiled in the other stuff that we're going to talk about in a bit. I mean, I wasn't surprised. I obviously voted yes to divest, along with the majority of students and faculty. But it wasn't surprising to me. I do wonder how surprising it was to those of you who were campaigning.
We weren't surprised. We knew this month's coming that it probably would be a no to divestment, but we were really hoping for at least some dialogue and potentially what we, as kind of a last-ditch effort, motioned was for the Board of Governors to realize that the process that they assessed divestment on was inadequate, non-transparent, and not evidence-based. And we understand that they were operating within a time crunch because we did throw two referendum votes on their desks and said, you need to address this, because they weren't going to address it any other way. But instead of taking steps of consultation and educating themselves, for the longest time, they didn't even know who we were. I think the first time we met them face-to-face was 2 weeks before the final decision. Like, that is just not due diligence. And if they keep on pulling due diligence, and fiduciary duty, you have a duty to represent the needs and wants of the two largest bodies that comprise your university, like faculty, who are the educators and who are creating these leaders from our society, and students who are going out and yelling and screaming and saying that we want a fossil fuel-free endowment fund. You can't keep on suppressing them. I find it so interesting, the hypocrisy at UBC. Everywhere you turn, there's the word sustainability flashed every single place you look. You look at a trash can, there's a pretty little face to tell you how to recycle. And yet, when it comes down to hard climate action, UBC is not willing to make the steps that it needs to. And we know, science is telling us that we cannot continue consuming these fossil fuels at the rate that we are, especially with the recent science about the degree centigrades. If we are looking to lower it by 1.5, there's no way we can be burning these fossil fuels. And we need to create the political space to empower and to push forward green technologies that can replace these super destructive sources of energy.
I have a question for you, Steph, regarding other Canadian universities. Is there a good example or that UBC should be following? Is there another Canadian university of similar size and similar, you know, status that that UBC should aspire to?
Yeah, thank
regarding
you.
Divestment.
For sure, thank you for that. So the three largest endowment funds in Canada right now are held by UBC, McGill, and U of T. Both of the other two universities have a huge divestment campaign going on as well. U of T is kind of the poster child right now for the divestment movement in Canada, as far as universities. What happened with U of T is, instead of following kind of backwards processes and old policies and trying to fit things to fit arguments into a really tight box, what happened is U of T actually created an entirely separate panel to assess divestment from the Board of Governors, or that we're not Board of Governors members, and they were third-party members. So the way UBC did it is, we had a financial investing committee. So they often backtracked to the argument of due diligence, fiduciary duty to create money for the university. But when you have a third-party run committee, they can start to bring in things such as questions of governance, questions of power, and questions of more responsibility to start making climate action a priority in a university. McGill is kind of in the same steps as we are. I believe they have received a no as well. So I think the campaign to look to for leadership right now is U of T, because they are the board that was comprised of the third party members. They have voted yes to divestment, and this is something we should consider as a university, and this is something that needs to be brought to the next step to being addressed.
I think it's also, the decision is very timely in terms of global events, you know, with the climate summit and the sustainable development goals put forward by the UN. For me, it's a harsh reminder that capitalism and sustainable development don't go hand in hand, and whether or not they can actually coexist.
Yeah.
And it sort of is a micro-level example of that.
For sure. In the Board of Governors meeting, a really interesting and sad but humorous point was raised by actually Greg Peet, who is the chair of the Responsible Investments Committee. And during the meeting, just as we were wrapping things up, just as we said our final words, he mentioned that CAP, so the Canadian Association of Petroleum Producers, they also approached the Board of Governors to have a meeting about divestment. And they were patting themselves on the back for denying them a meeting and said, since we denied CAP a meeting, who are an advocacy group, we were being really unbiased about the situation. This is really great. Good for us. We didn't meet with the Canadian Association of Petroleum Producers, but when you use that as an argument to not meet with a group of students, faculty, and staff who have been like surrounding themselves with divestment for the past 2.5 years, it's crazy. Like, it's just so disappointing, you know? Like,
and those are the people who comprise the community as
exactly, well. That's the community. So just, yeah, I think it's so funny that they truly believe, I don't know, it really looks like there is huge holdings, huge power holdings with these fossil fuel companies in making decisions. We know our Board of Governors are appointed members, and we know a lot of them are really invested in LNG and are invested in the things that we're trying to divest from. So you have to call to question what, if you don't have a transparent policy to assess divestment, people's brains are automatically going to be questioning where you are making your decisions from, as they should be.
So I want to move on to the next story. So the GSS released their report on how the UBC handled the sexual assault allegations that were covered in CBC, the Fifth Estate's documentary School of Secrets. And UBC insiders reported that there were attempts on the part of some GSS executives to bury this report. And GSS President Tobias Friedel subsequently released an apology. And Gabrielle, as the GS advocacy officer, you actually wrote this report. What can you tell me about it and the issues surrounding it?
Gosh, that's a big question. Well, so this was a report that was produced as a result of students coming to the office and basically being fed up with the university not responding to their concerns. And so I decided that it would be best to write a report that looks at the processes rather than focusing on the actual incident itself in an attempt to not re-traumatize those individuals coming forward. So we looked at the ways in which the university failed these students. And in my opinion, the university did fail these students. It's interesting to look at the apology that was subsequently produced and published by the GSS president. It actually contains a number of falsities. So, for example, it says that the president did not receive the final report until February 15th. That's not true. The president received the report February 3rd, so had it almost 2 weeks longer than they said in the apology. And the Harassment and Discrimination Committee that is referred to in that apology was also not struck until late September, as opposed to the summer, as it says in the report.
Would you say you didn't take the apology seriously, or what was your sort of reaction to that?
It's a very similar apology that was circulated by the university that everyone at the university received. It's a sorry I got caught, not sorry that I didn't do anything. I think as I was sort of going through the process of writing the report and coming to completion, I thought there might be some pushback, but I didn't quite realize how much pushback there would be and how much I would have to push for something to happen with this report. When I had an in-person meeting with the GSS president, it became clear that nothing was going to happen with this report. I also was unsure as to whether it had even been circulated to other executives beyond the VP, University and Academic Affairs, and the GSS president and the general manager. And from what I understand, none of the other executives knew of its existence, which is deeply concerning to me. So there are a lot of issues around now transparency in the Graduate Student Society itself. And those were issues that obviously came out of this whole process when these students were going to the university. And I think you expect a certain level of that when you're dealing with the university as a whole. But when you are going to a society that is meant to represent your needs and your interests as a graduate student, I don't think that you expect them to not do that.
And Efsef, you're not a graduate student, but what was your reaction upon seeing this report and the news surrounding it?
Well, I think seeing this, what I was reading through the report and I was excited. I was so excited because there are so many great points that we need to start implementing. We know that our justice system is failing victims of sexual assault, and it should be the responsibility of because the justice system should have a responsibility as well, but institutions do have a responsibility to address these huge concerns and acts of violence. And when they don't, and when they're not looking to, there's, I find it problematic that Gabby here, she made this really great document and presented it to them, putting so much work into it, and for them to not consider it, like the GSS to not even look at it, to not circulate it among executives, it's, I don't know why you wouldn't.
Perplexing. Yes. It's utterly perplexing.
Like, we are in 2016 right now.
Mm-hmm. And the thing was, no really adequate reason was given. And there was a lot of mirroring between the way that the individuals I dealt with at the GSS were behaving and the way that the university behaved. And I think that was really devastating for the students who had come forward asking for help. You know, a lot of conversation around due diligence and following proper protocols. And that was the rhetoric given by the university. That was then the rhetoric given by the GSS. And when I asked further questions around, okay, what are those proper protocols and processes? When I put that to the GSS president, I didn't get an answer for that question. So that's why I was still left with questions as to why nothing was happening with this report. But I think also, if we can talk a little bit about the Butler report too, which I think you wanted to do. One thing that I find particularly concerning in that report is the finding that there was not an unreasonable delay. So Paula Butler mentioned two areas of delay. One was a formal complaint that was put forward and not sent to the correct person for 2.5 months. And then another incident that had been reported and then no action was taken until 10 months later. And she uses case law. And the case that she's referring to when she's using case law is actually about fraud. And there is patient safety at risk in that particular case. But it's very different from a case of sexual violence where recidivism is a huge issue. Usually, individuals who commit acts of sexual violence have a pattern of committing acts of sexual violence. So, and I think there's also a statistic that 60% of sexual assault that is committed by a repeat offender. So it's seriously concerning that there's a 10-month delay between an incident being reported and then nothing happening. And that puts at risk, and did put at risk, the lives of other women and the safety of other women.
And Steph, what was your takeaway from the Butler report?
after like looking into the Butler report, I think my main takeaway was when you're trying to assess, first of all, the policies, UBC doesn't have a sexual assault policy. Number one problem there. Number two problem, when you try to assess whether or not the policy was adequate enough, it's a broken policy to begin with. Like, it isn't there. You can't fit in sexual assault to a broader discrimination and harassment policy. It's crazy that we don't have one yet. And also, when I was at the Board of Governors meeting, they did, they started the day talking about the Paula Butler report. And I think I share the same sentiment as the other 20 students in the room. We were squirming. The way that they brought forward the report is that it was, again, a pat on the back. Congratulations, Board of Governors. We had a third-party member come in and assess what happened. And at the end of the day, the report doesn't reflect too badly on them, but it should, because they, like, UBC is not taking the right steps in addressing sexual assault. And yeah, it was uncomfortable to be sitting in that room and having so many friends deal with sexual assault, and then having the governance structure at UBC essentially say, okay, well, we weren't that bad. We had some timing issues. Yes, we acknowledge we had timing issues, but beyond that, it's okay.
And the problem, I'll just quickly add too, the problem with a legal analysis of a situation like this is that the law does not allow for nuance. And there are so many shades of gray when you're dealing with sexual violence. Well, actually, no, I should take that back. It's pretty black and white. But in terms of understanding of policy, and as you mentioned, policy 3, which is seriously lacking in protecting students from sexual violence. But there needs to be more room for understanding and nuance in looking at these situations, particularly talking about unreasonable delays.
Well, thank you so much for joining me here in studio to talk about these issues.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Before we take to a PSA break, just want to remind all our listeners out there that this is indeed Fun Drive, and we would love to have your support. We are trying to raise $40,000. We are currently at $3,794.50, so we're almost 10% of the way there, but we still got a ways to go, so keep on donating. And thank you to all of those who have donated up till now. There's some amazing prizes. Remember, if you want to get some of this amazing CITR swag, just call in. And, you know, you can pick between a $30 prize, like a Friends of CITR card, or something really extravagant, like, you know, a $1,000 donation. Why not? You know, you could get your name on the wall in the new sub. How cool is that? There's growlers, there's notebooks, there's a whole swag bag. There's a lot of cool things. And this year, just to let you know, we have produced 11 radio documentaries. We have launched a women's collective, an indigenous collective, and an accessibility collective. So we're going to keep on growing our cultures, because that's what we do here at CITR. We got digital last year, but digital is not enough. You got to have the content. You got to have the people. And that's what we're trying to do. We're trying to support this amazing community. So keep on donating, folks. We'd love to get that number higher and higher. And thanks again to Stephanie and Gabrielle for joining us today. We're going to take a quick PSA break. Then we'll have Alex Norman's financial report. And after that, we'll have our AMS presidential election debate panel. So stay tuned, folks, right here on News 101 on CITR 101.9 FM.
This is the weekly financial update report with Alex Norman, keeping you updated with what's going on in the markets. These are this week's top stories. Stark warnings from the governor of Bank of England. Oprah sheds 42 million overnight as Weight Watchers slides. Caterpillar and Deere to cut 170 jobs. And Mars bars are to be recalled in Europe. We begin today's news with a stark warning from Mark Carney, the governor of the Bank of England. In a speech at the start of a two-day gathering of 20 key financial ministers and central bankers in Shanghai,
Carney warned his colleagues that getting embroiled in a currency war by pushing interest rates too low can only cause problems for the world economy. Quote, "The global economy is at risk of being trapped in a low-growth, low-inflation, low-interest rate equilibrium, and that nations can't simply export their problems through currency depreciation, noting that there is no, quote, free lunch. It looks like Oprah's getting fit, and her investments are slimming too. Shares for Weight Watchers were down 28% in the pre-trading hours on Friday, opening at $11.28, after the weight loss company reported on Thursday a drop in sales for 12 straight quarters and a continued decline in active subscribers. This is a trend that not even Oprah Winfrey could stop after she took on the role of the company's spokeswoman and taking on a large portion of the company's shares. With the stock slide, Ms. Winfrey lost $42.4 million on paper overnight and is down $165 million on her investment since shares of Weight Watchers peaked in mid-November at $28.05 a share. Ms. Winfrey joined Weight Watchers as the company attempted to revive the brand, which has been struggling amidst growing competition and preference among millennials for healthy eating and fitness versus solely relying on weight loss plans. Shares for Weight Watchers were down today, closing at $11 for a 29.26% loss. It looks like the grass isn't greener on the other side for Caterpillar and Deere. Caterpillar Inc. and Deere & Co. said on Friday that it's cutting a total of 170 jobs in their factories in yet another step to consolidate a slumping U.S. heavy machinery sector. Deere, a leading maker of farm and construction equipment, said 100 employees will be in place on indefinite layoff effective April 1st in two of the company's factories in Iowa, which make construction and forestry machinery. Caterpillar, the world's largest maker of construction and mining equipment, said it will halt production on highway trucks in plants in Texas, eliminating 70 jobs. Both companies have faced declining sales as global construction activity slows. Deere's shares closed down today 0.11% at $79.51 per share. Caterpillar's shares were up today 0.6% to close at $66.78 per share. It looks like they found plastic on Mars. Chocolate, that is. Mars Inc. has recalled chocolate bars and other products in 55 countries, mainly in Europe, after a piece of plastic was found in a Snickers bar in Germany. All of the recalled products, which includes Mars Snickers Milky Way bars, were manufactured in a Dutch factory, according to a Mars spokeswoman. They were sold in European countries, including Germany, France, Britain, and certain Asian countries. The recall, in effect since Monday, follows a January 8th complaint from a consumer in Germany. She said she found a red piece of plastic in a Snickers bar and sent it back to the company. Quote, "We cannot be sure that the plastic was only found in this particular Snickers bar," said a spokeswoman from Mars Netherlands. "We do not want any of our products on the market that do not meet our quality requirements, so we decided to take them all back." In other market news, Toronto's S&P TSX Composite Index was up today 0.35% to close at 12,798 points. The broader S&P 500 index stayed relatively flat today, posting a loss of 0.19% on the day to close at 1,948 points. The Nasdaq closed higher today with a gain of 0.18%. In the European markets, the German DAX closed up today 1.95%. In the Asian indices, markets stayed relatively flat as the Japanese Nikkei posted a gain of 0.3% and the Shanghai Composite Index had a gain of 0.95%. In the commodities markets, March gold futures closed up 1.23% to close at $1,223 an ounce, while the April crude futures were down 0.69% to close at $32.84 a barrel. In natural gas, April future contracts were up 0.11% to close at $1.78 a unit. Turning to the bond market, yields for 10-year Canadian bonds are currently at 1.197%. U.S. 10-year treasuries at a rate of 1.764%. This has been the Weekly Financial Update Report with Alex Norman, keeping you updated with what's going on in the markets.
When you join Balloon Club, we guarantee that you will be able to make a balloon poodle within the first day.
Here at the UBC Ant Club, we just like to talk about ants and compare ant farms. It's really cool.
Paperclip Club is all about, well, paperclips mostly.
At Blah Club, you can blah blah, blah 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 blah.
Explosion! There's only one club worth joining at UBC, and that's CITR 101.9 FM. We got free tickets to shows, whirly pops, professional help in all types of audio engineering, passes to festivals, crazy parties, live band swag. All types of crazy people. Our programming manager rides a motorcycle. There's freestyle rapping, Nardwar the Human Serviette, the vinyl and record libraries, Discorder magazine, free studio recording, and it sure beats the hell out of Paperclip Club, which is a thing that I just made up because I work at CITR. So come check us out on the floor of the Student Union Building. We got all types of crazy shit for you to do. Or check us out online at www.citr.ca.
Rocket from Russia and CITR presents Resolve Records Launch Party March 12th at the Media Club. Local record label Resolve Records launched their new website on the internet. It is magical. You can order vinyl records on this website. To celebrate that, we invited five awesome local bands to play a show. Contra Code, Ubik Idiot, The Greatest Sons, The Bins, and The Expectants, who are kinda all the way from Australia. It is gonna be a killer night. I think the great success is inevitable. March 12th at the Media Club, $10 to get in and enjoy great local punk rock music.
Ocean, border, sub, urban, dispersal, determinacy, mulatto, mestizo, Métis, Cabra, Eurasian, Creole, colored, colored, split. Those who have no history are doomed.
An excerpt from The Reinventing Wheel, spoken by author, Vancouver poet, Wade Compton. Celebrate Black History Month with CITR 101.9 FM as we host content exploring Black history in Vancouver and beyond. Tune in this February and check out CITR.ca for regular updates on the scheduling of our Black History Month programming.
Hi there. Are you tired of listening to the same music day in and day out and want to try something a little different? Well then, how about listening to Asian music? Now, I don't mean it like
Open Gangnam Style.
Nor like
She bangs, she bangs. Oh baby, but she moves, she moves.
I'm talking about a little more like and a little more like and also a little more like and definitely something like so tune in to Asian Wave 101, playing you the best of Chinese and Korean pop, Wednesdays from 4 p.m. to 5 p.m. only on CITR 101.9 FM in Vancouver.
Here in Vancouver, we celebrate our diversity and culture, and CITR is making Fun Drive all about it. Our goal this year is to raise funds to help grow more writers, broadcasters, and media producers, increasing the unique voices that grace our airwaves. Whether it's about specific cultural communities, musical genres, or alternative news, we want to hear it. Be a part of CITR's community. Donate, get cool swag, and party with us. Call 604-822-8648, that's 604-UBC-UNIT, or donate online at citr.ca/donate.
What better way to end off a week-long fun drive than with a kick-ass party? On March 4th, join us at the Hindenburg on West Cordova from 8 p.m. to 2 a.m. for a night-long celebration of all your support and commitment to community radio. It's one rad night you won't want to miss. We've got a silent auction, CITR DJs spinning, and the launch of Pop Alliance Volume 4 with Mint Records. To help us launch the album, we've got Morning Coup, Stefana Fratila, Late Spring, Aura Kogan, Ace Martins, Jerk Jails, and Kelp Babies coming to perform for you. Tickets are $10 online or $12 at the door. For tickets and info, check out CITR on Facebook.
Well, Welcome back to News 101. You're listening to us on CITR 101.9 FM or online at citr.ca, broadcasting live from unceded Musqueam territory here at the University of British Columbia in Vancouver. Thank you for being with us.
So this week, the AMS elections are in full swing, and the first candidate debates took place earlier this week. Today in studio, we have AMS presidential candidates Jenna O'Massey.
Hi.
And we also have David Alexander Brown, a.k.a. Aloha Dave. Dave?
Yeah, aloha. I'm up in Whistler.
Up in Whistler. Thank you for joining us. Thank you so much for joining us from up high in Whistler. Avan Nasiri could not join us. She was feeling a bit ill. And Sugar Brewer and Hassan Pakir could not make it today. We did not hear back from Thomas Thompson III, a.k.a. Kylo Ren, unfortunately. But to start off, we'll have the candidates introduce themselves and give a short description of their platform. So, Jenna, we'll start with you, and then we'll go to Dave. So, Jenna, first things off, introduce and tell us a little bit about yourself and your platforms.
Thank you so much. So my name is Jenna O'Massey. I am the current AMS Vice President, Academic and University Affairs, and a student senator. I've previously been the AUS president, been involved in UBC sororities, in residence life, and more. And I'm running to be your AMS president because I think I can make some really great change to the society, having been involved for the last few years. My platform and what I want to do for you fall under a few categories. The first is community. We struggle every year to build community on this campus. But if you look at other university campuses that have phenomenal community, the reason they do so is because they have something to rally behind. And for us, that can be athletics. So why can't we get students out to athletic games and rally them and make sure the community is built through varsity athletics, ensuring as well that the university supports community and that we do a nest review to really make sure that the AMS student nest is working for you. The second piece is well-being, making sure that we walk the walk, that we keep advocating for mental health and well-being services, but we don't really do it ourselves. Offering funds for clubs that want to make sure to put some well-being programming into their mix, as well as advocating for well-being in athletic facilities, no more bird coop. And finally, governance. This year, the AMS is going through a review of everything it does, and next year the president is going to have to implement this review. And having a lot of experience internally at the AMS, both in businesses and in kind of all those policies and documents that no one really knows about, I think that I can do some really great stuff, including revamping the way we give out funds, making sure that the businesses are brought back to students so that they can actually thrive, figuring out what to do with that empty space on the top floor and asking students what they want, and finally making a strategic plan for advocacy. So that's kind of what I want to do for you.
Thank you, Jenna. And how about you, Dave?
I'm Aloha Dave, and I'm running for president mostly because of the $100 million in oil company shares that we voted 2 years ago to divest from our trust fund or from our endowment fund. It's been over 2 years. Nothing's been done about it. 77% of the students voted yes. Then it went to the faculty, and they voted, I think, 63% to divest. It's not a new concept. Harvard's divested their oil company shares. So Stanford. A lot of universities stateside have done the same thing. I was kind of embarrassed by an article in The Sun a week or so ago that said, UBC going the way of the dinosaur. They're talking again about fiduciary duty. It seems is more important than democracy and moral responsibility. So that's the main motivation that I'm running for president.
All right, thank you, Dave. So first things first, we're going to start off with a question about diversity.
So UBC is a diverse campus with a large student population. As president, how do you intend to engage the student body?
We'll go with Jenna first, yeah.
Thanks. So really great question. This year, as the Vice President of Academic and University Affairs, as we know, this year was a very interesting one for the university. And so I had a lot on my plate and actually worked a lot with the current president of the AMS to go through those and navigate through those issues. And one of those especially was diversity. It came up in a number of issues, including the international tuition increases. And what we actually achieved was getting the university to put forward money to supporting diversity in the next couple of years. But that's not enough, because you're right. Not everyone is included in the AMS. We have a number of students who work to engage diverse populations and marginalized populations, but we're really not doing our part. And so I think the first piece would be to actually be engaging properly with the 410 clubs that we have on this campus. We do really well at sending communications to them, but not really bringing them into us. And a lot of them do represent a lot of the groups that we don't think about. Many other groups we actually have some sort of representation for at the AMS, but aren't using it effectively. So Aboriginal Students Commissioner, International Students Commissioner. I would see it bringing a student to work with refugee students, because we're hoping to build the refugee program here. And so I think it's using the pieces that we already have within the AMS, but making them a little more effective in the way that they reach out to specific populations, and recognizing that we're actually not representing all populations on this campus, and figuring out how to reach out to those other populations that don't necessarily engage with the society of 50,000 is a tricky one. And I can't say I have all the answers, but I think that we're moving in the right direction in trying to ensure that we have students who actually work for the AMS, whose job it is to reach out and touch base with those populations.
And Dave, same question to you.
Diversity, I'm all in favor of it. I believe in freedom totally. I think we have over 370 clubs at AMS right now. That's a pretty good example of our diversity right there. Well, I think that's about says it.
Thank you.
All right, and next up, we'll talk about mental health. So mental health and wellness was a big theme at the debate. What will you do as president to support the mental well-being of UBC students? Dave, we'll start with you for this one.
One thing is I'm endorsing the referendum for the... I just got an email from the Jazz Cafe about setting up some entertainment and arts facility things. Looks like we'll be using the old Student Union building for live performances and artwork and things like that. And we could probably set up some easier contact offices over there for people with any kind of emotional problems or situations. If anybody needs help, I think help should be available.
Fair enough. And how about you, Jenna? What would you propose for helping improve the well-being of UBC students, mental health-wise?
So mental health and well-being is actually in the AMS, situated under my current role, the VP Academic and University Affairs. And it's also one that in the last couple of years we've realized is deeply tied to academia and academic culture and academic policy. And so student senators have been really involved. And so this year as a student senator and as the VP Academic, I've been very involved in those changes. Some changes that we were able to achieve this year is a review of university scheduling that'll happen this summer, where the consideration of a fall reading break and of pushing back the withdrawal deadline, as well as a consideration of making sure that syllabi are offered in every course and are systematically providing proper expectations for students, are things that we've actually achieved this year. But next steps for specifically mental health and academic policy will be to make sure that what is being discussed in the reviews is properly consultative of the university as a whole, but also is implemented properly, because we have this kind of tendency at UBC to do a lot of projects and do a lot of research and not do a lot of implementation. So as president, I want to make sure to implement all those things that we've been working so hard to do this year, continuing hopefully on Senate as well. But beyond that, thinking about how mental health is so deeply tied to all other aspects of well-being, everything from physical activity and sedentary behavior to campus build and environment. There's this amazing initiative called Wellbeing at UBC, and it's supposed to bring together what they identify as five elements of well-being all together, thinking that if one is upheld, then the rest are going to thrive as well. And so continuing to work with them and making sure that there's proper facilities, not only for example, athletic use, but also for mental health facilities. So, for example, there's an auxiliary counseling services office in kind of next to Marine Drive that has moved there because they can't find proper space. So looking at the old sub and how we can bring services in there, because that was a consideration to be made, and then offering funds to clubs who are promoting mental health and well-being to make sure that they know that there's support from the AMS and can actually do more of the great things that they do. So I think it's about carrying on what we've done this year and implementing and capitalizing off of the work of student leaders from the past.
So an issue that's gained a lot of attention on campus recently is how sexual assault allegations are handled. And the AMS hasn't said a lot on this issue. If elected, is this something you intend to support students on? And if so, how? And Jenna, since you're currently part of the AMS, I'll start with you.
Absolutely. So so I actually disagree on that point that the AMS hasn't done a lot. My office actually put out an external sexual assault policy a few months ago, and December 2nd was the date. I remember because it was my birthday. And this policy very clearly stated that the AMS was going to push for changes within a lot of the practices and processes that the university has, but also work with the provincial government, which we've been doing, and work on creating a sexual assault policy. A committee that I actually currently sit on is the creation of that policy. And I think something that the AMS, working very closely with one of our services, the Sexual Assault Support Center, has realized is that policy is great. We love policy. But policy doesn't do anything if the processes and different ways in which students have to navigate these issues aren't properly managed, properly upheld. The non-academic misconduct process is problematic. Equity and inclusion isn't a welcoming and safe place. So we've also been working to push that piece along with working with the university on prevention and education. So it's a really complex issue. And the reason not many people have seen a lot happen is because a lot of people expect this policy and that it will solve the world's problems. But ultimately, what needs to be fixed is everything underlying the policy. And so we've been working a lot behind the scenes to fix that, hoping that the university, especially after this year, but ongoing, takes this issue very seriously, and realizing that as the AMS, we have to be allies, but we also have to be advocates.
And Dave, as president, what is your stance on this issue?
I'm kind of happy with the consent posters that are around campus right now, telling people just exactly what consent is required for any kind of activity of that nature. If there's any kind of assault that crosses those lines, I think there should be instant availability for counseling and for reporting and doing something about it. It's a legal matter. It's not an emotional matter. I'm not sure exactly how we could do much better, but readily available counseling and legal advice, so that would be a good start. And I think the campaign for consent around campus is working pretty good. That could be amplified a little better.
All right, guys. And just to wrap things up, in 1 minute, can you summarize what you will bring that is unique to the presidency? Jenna, we'll start with you.
Absolutely. 1 minute. Okay. I've been involved in the AMS for 2 years and in campus organizations for four. I bring a diversity of experiences, having been deeply involved in many different communities on this campus, but also something that differs from the other candidates is that I do have not only internal knowledge of the AMS, everything from our governing documents to the businesses to how clubs run, et cetera, but also a very external view, having worked very deeply with the university this year and having a very good knowledge of everything from the board to the Senate to the university administration and the provincial government and federal government. And so I think I have a very rounded view of the society and a very big knowledge base about how we can use that to move forward. The other thing that I just like to say is that I think I've demonstrated this year that I am both realistic and honest in the promises that I've put forward. Last year in my campaign, I put forward a number of promises and owned up to those and have actually finished all my goals in the last 8 months. And so I think I can also definitely say that I will deliver on every single promise I'm making during this campaign.
Thank you, Jenna. Dave, what makes you unique in your bid to become president? What would you bring?
to the table?
Well, I'd like to do that divestment thing right away, get that happening. With some of that money, we could invest it back in UBC. I wouldn't mind starting a UBC TV, broadcasting or webcasting or whatever the council meetings to make them more accessible to all the students and have more student participation in the political situation at AMS. A few things like that. Free tuition could be an option coming up if Barry Sanders wins in the United States and his platform is free tuition. We're going to have to acknowledge that and do something about it here in Canada. What else can we do? I wouldn't mind doing a study for every 41 departments at the university to see what they think or where we're heading in the next 10, 20, and 50 years, and get some kind of vision as to where our university is going to go in the next 10, 20, or 50 years, and set a course in that direction. We've just completed 100 years. We're a well-respected university worldwide. I'd like to continue that process.
All right. Thank you so much, Dave and Jenna, for joining us. Please make sure, if you're tuning in right now and you are a UBC student, make sure that you vote before March 4th. You can read all of the candidate platforms and find out about election events on the AMS website. We also have audio from the first AMS debate, which you can find on News 101's Mixcloud, Facebook, and Twitter pages.
That's our program for today, February 26th. Today's newscast was brought to you by Volunteer Efforts. If you'd like to share your comments, get involved, or give us an important news tip, contact us through our Facebook, Twitter, or email us at news@citr.ca.
You can subscribe to our podcast and listen to our latest interviews on our website, citr.ca/radio-news101. You can also find great content on our SoundCloud and Mixcloud pages. For more independent news, join us next Friday at 5 p.m. for another edition of News 101. I'm Rohit Joseph.
And I'm Emily Blake. Today's broadcast was produced by Rohit Joseph. From the entire news team at CITR, thank you for listening. And great content like today's panels are made possible through community support. So make sure to call 604-822-8648 or visit citr.ca/donate to make a pledge.
Stay tuned for Lady Radio from the Women's Collective right here on CITR 101.9 FM.
Most powerful motivational speeches that I have ever heard came from people who told me I couldn't do something. You know why? Because when they told me I couldn't do it, I was bound and determined to show them that I could.
Did you know CITR has an accessibility collective? Our new collective serves to explore issues of inclusion, equity, and accessibility for people with physical and cognitive disabilities on campus and beyond. If you love making radio, listening to radio, or want to get involved for the first time, come join our collective. We include people of all abilities, experience levels, and backgrounds in the production and programming of our show. Tune in to our weekly show, All Access Pass, from 5 to 6 p.m. on Thursdays for interviews, music, news, events, and awesome dialogues. If you want to get involved, email accessibilitycollective@citr.ca. If only I could dream
we could start again. What better way to end off a week-long fun drive than with a kick-ass party? On March 4th, join us at the Hindenburg on West Cordova from 8 p.m. to 2 a.m. for a night-long celebration of all your support and commitment to community radio. It's one rad night you won't want to miss. We've got a silent auction, CITR DJs spinning, and the launch of Pop Alliance Volume 4 with Mint Records. To help us launch the album, we've got Morning Coup, Stefana Fratila, Late Spring, Laura Kogan, Ace Martins, Jerk Jails,